or conceptions of the understanding. In the metaphysical deduction, the a priori origin of categories was proved by their complete accordance with the general logical of thought. In the transcendental deduction was exhibited the possibility of the categories as a priori cognitions of objects of an intuition in general, SS 16 and 17. At present, we are about to explain the possibility of cognizing a priori by means of the categories all objects which can possibly be presented to our senses, not indeed according to the form of their intuition, but according to the laws of their conjunction or synthesis, and thus, as it were, of prescribing laws to nature and even of rendering nature possible. For if the categories were inadequate to this task, it would not be evident to us why everything that is presented to our senses must be subject to those laws which have an a priori origin in the understanding itself. I premise that by the term synthesis of apprehension, I understand the combination of the manifold in an empirical intuition, whereby perception, that is, empirical consciousness of the intuition as phenomenon, is possible. We have a priori forms of the external and internal sensuous intuition in the representations of space and time, and to these must the synthesis of apprehension of the manifold in a phenomenon be always conformable, because the synthesis itself can only take place according to these forms. But space and time are not merely forms of sensuous intuition, but intuitions themselves, which contain a manifold, and therefore contain a priori the determination of the unity of this manifold. See footnote. See the transcendent aesthetic. Therefore is unity of the synthesis of the manifold without or within us, consequently also a conjunction to which all that is to be represented as determined in space or time must correspond, given a priori along with, not in, these intuitions, as the condition of the synthesis of all apprehension of them. But this synthetical unity can be no other than that of the conjunction of the manifold of a given intuition in general in a primitive act of consciousness according to the categories, but applied to our sensuous intuition. Consequently, all synthesis, whereby alone is even perception possible, is subject to the categories. And as experience is cognition by means of conjoined perceptions, the categories are conditions of the possibility of experience and are therefore valid a priori for all objects of experience. Footnote. Space represented as an object, as geometry really requires it to be, contains more than the mere form of the intuition, namely, a combination of the manifold given according to the form of sensibility into a representation that can be intuited. So that the form of the intuition gives us merely the manifold, but the formal intuition gives unity of representation. In the aesthetic, I regarded this unity as belonging entirely to sensibility, for the purpose of indicating that it antecedes all conceptions, although it presupposes a synthesis which does not belong to sense, through which alone, however, all our conceptions of space and time are possible. For as by means of this unity alone, the understanding determining the sensibility, space and time are given as intuitions, it follows that the unity of this intuition a priori belongs to space and time, and not to the conception of the understanding. SS 20. When then, for example, I make the empirical intuition of a house by apprehension of the manifold contained therein into a perception, the necessary unity of space and of my external sensuous intuition lies at the foundation of this act. And I, as it were, draw the form of the house conformably to this synthetical unity of the manifold in space. But this very synthetical unity remains even when I abstract the form of space, and has its seat in the understanding, and is, in fact, the category of the synthesis of the homogeneous in an intuition. That is to say, the category of quantity to which the aforesaid synthesis of apprehension, that is, the perception, must be completely conformable. See footnote. Footnote. In this manner it is proved that the synthesis of apprehension, which is empirical, must necessarily be conformable to the synthesis of apperception, which is intellectual, and contained a priori in the category. It is one and the same spontaneity which at one time, under the name of imagination, at another time under that of understanding, produces conjunction in the manifold of intuition. To take another example, when I perceive the freezing of water, I apprehend two states, fluidity and solidity, which, as such, stand toward each other mutually in a relation of time. But in the time which I place as an internal intuition at the foundation of this phenomenon, I represent to myself synthetical unity of the manifold, without which the aforesaid relation could not be given in an intuition as determined, in regard to the succession of time. Now this synthetical unity, as the a priori condition under which I conjoin the manifold of an intuition, is, if I make abstraction of the permanent form of my internal intuition, that is to say, of time, the category of cause, by means of which, when applied to my sensibility, I determine everything that occurs according to relations of time. Consequently, apprehension in such an event, and the event itself, as far as regards the possibility of its perception, stands under the conception of the relation of cause and effect, and so in all other cases. Categories are conceptions which prescribe laws a priori to phenomena, consequently to nature as the complex of all phenomena, natura materialiter spectata. And now the question arises, inasmuch as these categories are not derived from nature and do not regulate themselves according to her as their model, for in that case they would be empirical, how it is conceivable that nature must regulate herself according to them? In other words, how the categories can determine a priori the synthesis of the manifold of nature and yet not derive their origin from her? The following is the solution of this enigma. It is not in the least more difficult to conceive how the laws of the phenomena of nature must harmonize with the understanding and with its a priori form, that is, its faculty of conjoining the manifold, than it is to understand how the phenomena themselves must correspond with the a priori form of our sensuous intuition. For laws do not exist in the phenomena any more than the phenomena exist as things in themselves. Laws do not exist except by relation to the subject in which the phenomena inhere, in so far as it possesses understanding, just as phenomena have no existence except by relation to the same existing subject in so far as it has senses. To things as things in themselves, conformability to law must necessarily belong independently of an understanding to cognize them. But phenomena are only representations of things which are utterly unknown in respect to what they are in themselves. But as mere representations, they stand under no law of conjunction except that which the conjoining faculty prescribes. Now that which conjoins the manifold of sensuous intuition is imagination, a mental act to which understanding contributes unity of intellectual synthesis and sensibility, manifoldness of apprehension. Now, as all possible perception depends on the synthesis of apprehension, and this empirical synthesis itself on the transcendental, consequently, on the categories, it is evident that all possible perceptions, and therefore everything that can attain to empirical consciousness, that is, all phenomena of nature, must, as regards their conjunction, be subject to the categories. And nature, considered merely as nature in general, is dependent on them as the original ground of her necessary conformability to law, as natura formaliter spectata. But the pure faculty of the understanding, of prescribing laws a priori to phenomena by means of mere categories, is not competent to enounce other or more laws than those on which a nature in general, as a conformability to law of phenomena of space and time, depends. Particular laws, inasmuch as they concern empirically determined phenomena, cannot be entirely deduced from pure laws, although they all stand under them. Experience must be superadded in order to know these particular laws. But in regard to experience in general and everything that can be cognized as an object thereof, these a priori laws are our only rule and guide. SS 23. Result of this deduction of the conceptions of the understanding. We cannot think any object except by means of the categories. We cannot cognize any thought except by means of intuitions corresponding to these conceptions. Now all our intuitions are sensuous, and our cognition, in so far as the object of it is given, is empirical. But empirical cognition is experience. Consequently, no a priori cognition is possible for us except of objects of possible experience. See footnote. Footnote. Lest my readers should stumble at this assertion and the conclusions that may be too rashly drawn from it, I must remind them that the categories in the act of thought are by no means limited by the conditions of our sensuous intuition, but have an unbounded sphere of action. It is only the cognition of the object of thought, the determining of the object, which requires intuition. In the absence of intuition, our thought of an object may still have true and useful consequences in regard to the exercise of reason by the subject. But as this exercise of reason is not always directed on the determination of the object, in other words, on cognition thereof, but also on the determination of the subject and its volition, I do not intend to treat of it in this place. But this cognition, which is limited to objects of experience, is not, for that reason, derived entirely from experience, but, and this is asserted of the pure intuitions and the pure conceptions of the understanding, there are, unquestionably, elements of cognition which exist in the mind a priori. Now, there are only two ways in which a necessary harmony of experience with the conceptions of its objects can be cogitated. Either experience makes these conceptions possible, or the conceptions make experience possible. The former of these statements will not hold good with respect to the categories, nor in regard to pure sensuous intuition, for they are a priori conceptions, and therefore independent of experience. The assertion of an empirical origin would attribute to them a sort of generatio equivoca. Consequently, nothing remains but to adopt the second alternative, which presents us with a system, as it were, of the epigenesis of pure reason, namely, that on the part of the understanding the categories do contain the grounds of the possibility of all experience. But with respect to the question how they make experience possible, and what are the principles of the possibility thereof with which they present us in their application to phenomena, the following section on the transcendental exercise of the faculty of judgment will inform the reader. It is quite possible that someone may propose a species of preformation system of pure reason, a middle way between the two, to wit, that the categories are neither innate and first a priori principles of cognition, nor derived from experience, but are merely subjective aptitudes for thought implanted in us contemporaneously with our existence, which were so ordered and disposed by our Creator that their exercise perfectly harmonizes with the laws of nature which regulate experience. Now, not to mention that with such an hypothesis it is impossible to say at what point we must stop in the employment of predetermined aptitudes, the fact that the categories would in this case entirely lose that character of necessity which is essentially involved in the very conception of them is a conclusive objection to it. The conception of cause, for example, which expresses the necessity of an effect under a presupposed condition would be false if it rested only upon such an arbitrary subjective necessity of uniting certain empirical representations according to such a rule of relation. I could not then say, the effect is connected with its cause in the object, that is, necessarily, but only, I am so constituted that I can think this representation as so connected, and not otherwise. Now this is just what the skeptic wants. For in this case, all our knowledge depending on the supposed objective validity of our judgment is nothing but mere illusion. Nor would there be wanting people who would deny any such subjective necessity in respect to themselves, though they must feel it. At all events, we could not dispute with anyone on that which merely depends on the manner in which his subject is organized. Short view of the above deduction. The foregoing deduction is an exposition of the pure conceptions of the understanding, and with them of all theoretical a priori cognition, as principles of the possibility of experience, but of experience as the determination of all phenomena in space and time in general. Of experience, finally, from the principle of the original synthetical unity of apperception as the form of the understanding in relation to time and space as original forms of sensibility. I consider the division by paragraphs to be necessary only up to this point because we had to treat of the elementary conceptions. As we now proceed to the exposition of the employment of these, I shall not designate the chapters in this manner any further. Book 2. Analytic of Principles. General logic is constructed upon a plan which coincides exactly with the division of the higher faculties of cognition. These are understanding, judgment, and reason. This science accordingly treats in its analytic of conceptions, judgments, and conclusions in exact correspondence with the functions and order of those mental powers which we include generally under the generic denomination of understanding. As this merely formal logic makes abstraction of all content of cognition, whether pure or empirical, and occupies itself with the mere form of thought, discursive cognition, it must contain in its analytic a canon for reason. For the form of reason has its law which, without taking into consideration the particular nature of the cognition about which it is employed, can be discovered a priori by the simple analysis of the action of reason into its momenta. Transcendental logic, limited as it is to a determinate content, that of pure a priori cognitions, to wit, cannot imitate general logic in this division. For it is evident that the transcendental employment of reason is not objectively valid, and therefore does not belong to the logic of truth, that is, to analytic, but as a logic of illusion, occupies a particular department in the scholastic system under the name of transcendental dialectic. Understanding and judgment accordingly possess in transcendental logic a canon of objectively valid, and therefore true, exercise, and are comprehended in the analytical department of that logic. But reason, in her endeavours to arrive by a priori means at some true statement concerning objects and to extend cognition beyond the bounds of possible experience, is altogether dialectic, and her illusory assertions cannot be constructed into a canon such as an analytic ought to contain. Accordingly, the analytic of principles will be merely a canon for the faculty of judgment, for the instruction of this faculty in its application to phenomena of the pure conceptions of the understanding, which contain the necessary condition for the establishment of a priori laws. On this account, although the subject of the following chapters is the especial principles of understanding, I shall make use of the term doctrine of the faculty of judgment in order to define more particularly my present purpose. Introduction. Of the transcendental faculty of judgment in general. If understanding in general be defined as the faculty of laws or rules, the faculty of judgment may be termed the faculty of subsumption under these rules, that is, of distinguishing whether this or that does or does not stand under a given rule, casus date legis. General logic contains no directions or precepts for the faculty of judgment, nor can it contain any such. For as it makes abstraction of all content of cognition, no duty is left for it except that of exposing analytically the mere form of cognition in conceptions, judgments, and conclusions, and of thereby establishing formal rules for all exercise of the understanding. Now, if this logic wished to give some general direction how we should subsume under these rules, that is, how we should distinguish whether this or that did or did not stand under them, this again could not be done otherwise than by means of a rule. But this rule, precisely because it is a rule, requires for itself direction from the faculty of judgment. Thus, it is evident that the understanding is capable of being instructed by rules, but that the judgment is a peculiar talent, which does not and cannot require tuition, but only exercise. This faculty is therefore the specific quality of the so-called mother wit, the want of which no scholastic discipline can compensate. For although education may furnish, and, as it were, engraft upon a limited understanding rules borrowed from other minds, yet the power of employing these rules correctly must belong to the pupil himself. And no rule which we can prescribe to him with this purpose is, in the absence or deficiency of this gift of nature, secure from misuse. See footnote. A physician, therefore, a judge or a statesman, may have in his head many admirable pathological, juridical or political rules in a degree that may enable him to be a profound teacher in his particular science, and yet, in the application of these rules, he may very possibly blunder, either because he is wanting in natural judgment, though not in understanding, and whilst he can comprehend the general in abstracto, cannot distinguish whether a particular case in concreto ought to rank under the former, or because his faculty of judgment has not been sufficiently exercised by examples and real practice. Indeed, the grand and only use of examples is to sharpen the judgment. For as regards the correctness and precision of the insight of the understanding, examples are commonly injurious rather than otherwise, because, as casus interminis, they seldom adequately fulfill the conditions of the rule. Besides, they often weaken the power of our understanding to apprehend rules or laws in their universality, independently of particular circumstances of experience, and hence accustom us to employ them more as formulae than as principles. Examples are thus the go-cart of the judgment, which he who is naturally deficient in that faculty cannot afford to dispense with. Footnote. Deficiency in judgment is properly that which is called stupidity, and for such a failing we know no remedy. A dull or narrow-minded person, to whom nothing is wanting but a proper degree of understanding, may be improved by tuition, even so far as to deserve the epithet of learned. But as such persons frequently labour under a deficiency in the faculty of judgment, it is not uncommon to find men extremely learned who, in the application of their science, betray a lamentable degree this irremediable want. But although general logic cannot give directions to the faculty of judgment, the case is very different as regards transcendental logic, insomuch that it appears to be the especial duty of the latter to secure and direct, by means of determinate rules, the faculty of judgment in the employment of the pure understanding. For, as a doctrine, that is, as an endeavour to enlarge the sphere of the understanding in regard to pure a priori cognitions, philosophy is worse than useless, since from all the attempts hitherto made, little or no ground has been gained. But as a critique, in order to guard against the mistakes of the faculty of judgment, lapsus judici, in the employment of the few pure conceptions of the understanding which we possess, although its use is in this case purely negative, philosophy is called upon to apply all its acuteness and penetration. But transcendental philosophy has this peculiarity, that besides indicating the rule, or rather the general condition for rules which is given in the pure conception of the understanding, it can at the same time indicate a priori the case to which the rule must be applied. The cause of the superiority which, in this respect, transcendental philosophy possesses above all other sciences except mathematics lies in this. It treats of conceptions which must relate a priori to their objects, whose objective validity consequently cannot be demonstrated a posteriori, and is, at the same time, under the obligation of presenting in general but sufficient tests, the conditions under which objects can be given in harmony with these conceptions. Otherwise, they would be mere logical forms without content, and not pure conceptions of the understanding. Our transcendental doctrine of the faculty of judgment will contain two chapters. The first will treat of the sensuous condition under which alone pure conceptions of the understanding can be employed, that is, of the schematism of the pure understanding. The second will treat of those synthetical judgments which are derived a priori from pure conceptions of the understanding under those conditions, and which lie a priori at the foundation of all other cognitions. That is to say, it will treat of the principles of the pure understanding. Transcendental doctrine of the faculty of judgment, or analytic of principles. Chapter 1. Of the schematism of the pure conceptions of the understanding. In all subsumptions of an object under a conception, the representation of the object must be homogeneous with the conception. In other words, the conception must contain that which is represented in the object to be subsumed under it. For this is the meaning of the expression, an object is contained under a conception. Thus, the empirical conception of a plate is homogeneous with the pure geometrical conception of a circle, inasmuch as the roundness which is cogitated in the former is intuited in the latter. But pure conceptions of the understanding, when compared with empirical intuitions, or even with sensuous intuitions in general, are quite heterogeneous, and never can be discovered in any intuition. How then is the subsumption of the latter under the former, and consequently the application of the categories to phenomena possible? For it is impossible to say, for example, causality can be intuited through the senses and is contained in the phenomenon. This natural and important question forms the real cause of the necessity of a transcendental doctrine of the faculty of judgment, with the purpose, to wit, of showing how pure conceptions of the understanding can be applied to phenomena. In all other sciences, where the conceptions by which the object is thought in the general are not so different and heterogeneous from those which represent the object in concreto, as it is given, it is quite unnecessary to institute any special inquiries concerning the application of the former to the latter. Now, it is quite clear that there must be some third thing which, on the one side, is homogeneous with the category and with the phenomenon on the other, and so makes the application of the former to the latter possible. This mediating representation must be pure, without any empirical content, and yet must on the one side be intellectual, on the other sensuous. Such a representation is the transcendental schema. The conception of the understanding contains pure synthetical unity of the manifold in general. Time, as the formal condition of the manifold of the internal sense, consequently of the conjunction of all representations, contains a priori a manifold in the pure intuition. Now, a transcendental determination of time is so far homogeneous with the category, which constitutes the unity thereof, that it is universal and rests upon a rule a priori. On the other hand, it is so far homogeneous with the phenomenon, inasmuch as time is contained in every empirical representation of the manifold. Thus, an application of the category to phenomena becomes possible by means of the transcendental determination of time, which, as the schema of the conceptions of the understanding, mediates the subsumption of the latter under the former. After what has been proved in our deduction of the categories, no one, it is to be hoped, can hesitate as to the proper decision of the question whether the employment of these pure conceptions of the understanding ought to be merely empirical or also transcendental. In other words, whether the categories, as conditions of a possible experience, relate a priori solely to phenomena, or whether, as conditions of the possibility of things in general, their application can be extended to objects as things in themselves. For we have there seen that conceptions are quite impossible, and utterly without signification, unless either to them, or at least to the elements of which they consist, an object be given, and that, consequently, they cannot possibly apply to objects as things in themselves without regard to the question whether and how these may be given to us, and further, that the only manner in which objects can be given to us is by means of the modification of our sensibility, and finally, that pure a priori conceptions, in addition to the function of the understanding in the category, must contain a priori formal conditions of sensibility, of the internal sense namely, which again contain the general condition under which alone the category can be applied to any object. This formal and pure condition of sensibility, to which the conception of the understanding is restricted in its employment, we shall name the schema of the conception of the understanding, and the procedure of the understanding with these schemata we shall call the schematism of the pure understanding. The schema is, in itself, always a mere product of the imagination. But, as the synthesis of imagination has for its aim no single intuition, but merely unity in the determination of sensibility, the schema is clearly distinguishable from the image. Thus, if I place 5 points, one after another, this is an image of the number 5. On the other hand, if I only think a number in general, which may be either 5 or 100, this thought is rather the representation of a method of representing in an image a sum, e.g. 1,000, in conformity with a conception, than the image itself, an image which I should find some little difficulty in reviewing and comparing with the conception. Now, this representation of a general procedure of the imagination to present its image to a conception, I call the schema of this conception. In truth, it is not images of objects but schemata which lie at the foundation of our pure sensuous conceptions. No image could ever be adequate to our conception of a triangle in general. For the generalness of the conception it never could attain to, as this includes under itself all triangles, whether right-angled, acute-angled, etc., whilst the image would always be limited to a single part of this sphere. The schema of the triangle can exist nowhere else than in thought, and it indicates a rule of the synthesis of the imagination in regards to pure figures in space. Still less is an object of experience or an image of the object ever to the empirical conception. On the contrary, the conception always relates immediately to the schema of the imagination as a rule for the determination of our intuition, in conformity with a certain general conception. The conception of a dog indicates a rule according to which my imagination can delineate the figure of a four-footed animal in general without being limited to any particular individual form which experience presents to me, or indeed to any possible image that I can represent to myself in concreto. This schematism of our understanding in regards to phenomena and their mere form is an art hidden in the depths of the human soul, whose true modes of action we shall only with difficulty discover and unveil. Thus much only we say, the image is a product of the empirical faculty of the productive imagination. The schema of sensuous conceptions, of figures in space, for example, is a product, and, as it were, a monogram of the pure imagination a priori, whereby and according to which images first become possible, which, however, can be connected with the conception only immediately by means of the schema which they indicate, and are in themselves never fully adequate to it. On the other hand, the schema of a pure conception of the understanding is something that cannot be reduced into any image. It is nothing else than the pure synthesis expressed by the category conformably to a rule of unity according to conceptions. It is a transcendental product of the imagination, a product which concerns the determination of the internal sense according to conditions of its form, time, in respect to all representations, insofar as these representations must be conjoined a priori in one conception, conformably to the unity of apperception. Without entering upon a dry and tedious analysis of the essential requisites of transcendental schemata of the pure conceptions of the understanding, we shall rather proceed at once to give an explanation of them according to the order of the categories and in connection therewith. For the external sense, the pure image of all quantities, quantorum, is space. The pure image of all objects of sense in general is time. But the pure schema of quantity, quantitatis, as a conception of the understanding is number, a representation which comprehends the successive addition of one to one, homogeneous quantities. Thus, number is nothing else than the unity of the synthesis of the manifold in a homogeneous intuition, by means of my generating time itself in my apprehension of the intuition. Reality, in the pure conception of the understanding, is that which corresponds to a sensation in general, that, consequently, the conception of which indicates a being in time. Negation is that the conception of which represents a not being in time. The opposition of these two consists, therefore, in the difference of one and the same time as a time filled or a time empty. Now, as time is only the form of intuition, consequently of objects as phenomena, that which in objects corresponds to sensation is the transcendental matter of all objects as things in themselves, sache it, reality. Now, every sensation has a degree or quantity by which it can fill time, that is to say, the internal sense in respect of the representation of an object, more or less, until it vanishes into nothing, equals zero, equals negatio. Thus, there is a relation and connection between reality and negation, or rather, a transition from the former to the latter, which makes every reality representable to us as a quantum. And the schema of a reality as the quantity of something insofar as it fills time is exactly this continuous and uniform generation of the reality in time as we descend in time from the sensation which has a certain degree down to the vanishing thereof, or gradually ascend from the negation to the quantity thereof. The schema of substance is the permanence of the real in time, that is, the representation of it as a substratum of the empirical determination of time, a substratum which therefore remains whilst all else changes. Time passes not, but in it passes the existence of the changeable. To time, therefore, which is itself unchangeable and permanent, corresponds that which in the phenomenon is unchangeable in existence, that is, substance, and it is only by it that the succession and coexistence of phenomena can be determined in regards to time. The schema of cause and of the causality of a thing is the real which, when posited, is always followed by something else. It consists, therefore, in the succession of the manifold, in so far as that succession is subjected to a rule. The schema of community, reciprocity of action and reaction, or the reciprocal causality of substances in respect of their accidents, is the coexistence of the determinations of the one with those of the other, according to a general rule. The schema of possibility is the accordance of the synthesis of different representations with the conditions of time in general, as, for example, opposites cannot exist together at the same time in the same thing, but only after each other, and is therefore the determination of the representation of a thing at any time. The schema of reality is existence in a determined time. The schema of necessity is the existence of an object in all time. It is clear from all this that the schema of the category of quantity contains and represents the generation, synthesis, of time itself in the successive apprehension of an object. The schema of quality, the synthesis of sensation with the representation of time or the filling up of time. The schema of relation, the relation of perceptions to each other in all time, that is, according to a rule of the determination of time. And finally, the schema of modality and its categories, time itself, as the correlative of the determination of an object, whether it does belong to time and how. The schemata, therefore, are nothing but a priori determinations of time according to rules, and these, in regard to all possible objects following the arrangement of the categories, relate to the series in time, the content in time, the order in time, and finally, to the complex or totality in time. Hence, it is apparent that the schematism of the understanding, by means of the transcendental synthesis of the imagination, amounts to nothing else than the unity of the manifold of intuition in the internal sense, and thus, indirectly, to the unity of apperception, as a function corresponding to the internal sense, a receptivity. Thus, the schemata of the pure conceptions of the understanding are the true and only conditions whereby our understanding receives an application to objects, and consequently significance. Finally, therefore, the categories are only capable of empirical use, inasmuch as they serve merely to subject phenomena to the universal rules of synthesis, by means of an a priori necessary unity, on account of the necessary union of all consciousness in one original apperception, and so to render them susceptible of a complete connection in one experience. But within this whole of possible experience lie all our cognitions, and in the universal relation to this experience consists transcendental truth, which antecedes all empirical truth and renders the latter possible. It is, however, evident at first sight that although the schemata of sensibility are the sole agents in realizing the categories, they do nevertheless also restrict them, that is, they limit the categories by conditions which lie beyond the sphere of understanding, namely, in sensibility. Hence, the schema is properly only the phenomenon or the sensuous conception of an object in harmony with the category, numerus est quantitas phenomenon, sensatio realitatis phenomenon, constans et perdurabile rerum substantia phenomenon, aeternitas necessitas phenomena, etc. Now, if we remove a restrictive condition, we thereby amplify, it appears, the formerly limited conception. In this way, the categories, in their pure signification, free from all conditions of sensibility, ought to be valid of things as they are, and not, as the schemata represent them, merely as they appear. And consequently, the categories must have a significance far more extended and wholly independent of all schemata. In truth, there does always remain to the pure conceptions of the understanding, after abstracting every sensuous condition, a value and significance which is, however, merely logical. But in this case, no object is given them, and therefore they have no meaning sufficient to afford us a conception of an object. The notion of substance, for example, if we leave out the sensuous determination of permanence, would mean nothing more than a something which can be cogitated as subject without the possibility of becoming a predicate to anything else. Of this representation I can make nothing, inasmuch as it does not indicate to me what determinations the thing possesses which must thus be valid as premier subject. Consequently, the categories without schemata are merely functions of the understanding for the production of conceptions, but do not represent any object. This significance they derive from sensibility, which at the same time realizes the understanding and restricts it. Chapter 2. System of all principles of the pure understanding. In the foregoing chapter, we have merely considered the general conditions under which alone the transcendental faculty of judgment is justified in using the pure conceptions of the understanding for synthetical judgments. Our duty at present is to exhibit in systematic connection those judgments which the understanding really produces a priori. For this purpose, our table of the categories will certainly afford us the natural and safe guidance. For it is precisely the categories whose application to possible experience must constitute all pure a priori cognition of the understanding, and the relation of which to sensibility will, on that very account, present us with a complete and systematic catalogue of all the transcendental principles of the use of the understanding. Principles a priori are so called not merely because they contain in themselves the grounds of other judgments, but also because they themselves are not grounded in higher and more general cognitions. This peculiarity, however, does not raise them altogether above the need of a proof. For although there could be found no higher cognition, and therefore no objective proof, and although such a principle rather serves as the foundation for all cognition of the object, this by no means hinders us from drawing a proof from the subjective sources of the possibility of the cognition of an object. Such a proof is necessary, moreover, because without it the principle might be liable to the imputation of being a mere gratuitous assertion. In the second place, we shall limit our investigations to those principles which relate to the categories. For as to the principles of transcendental aesthetic, according to which space and time are the conditions of the possibility of things as phenomena, as also the restriction of these principles, namely, that they cannot be applied to objects as things in themselves, these, of course, do not fall within the scope of our present inquiry. In like manner, the principles of mathematical science form no part of this system, because they are all drawn from intuition, and not from the pure conception of the understanding. The possibility of these principles, however, will necessarily be considered here, inasmuch as they are synthetical judgments a priori, not indeed for the purpose of proving their accuracy and apodeictic certainty, which is unnecessary, but merely to render conceivable and deduce the possibility of such evident a priori cognitions. But we shall have also to speak of the principle of analytical judgments in opposition to synthetical judgments, which is the proper subject of our inquiries, because this very opposition will free the theory of the latter from all ambiguity and place it clearly before our eyes in its true nature. System of the Principles of the Pure Understanding. Section 1. Of the Supreme Principle of All Analytical Judgments. Whatever may be the content of our cognition, and in whatever manner our cognition may be related to its object, the universal, although only negative, conditions of all our judgments is that they do not contradict themselves. Otherwise, these judgments are in themselves, even without respect to the object, nothing. But although there may exist no contradiction in our judgment, it may nevertheless connect conceptions in such a manner that they do not correspond to the object, or without any grounds either a priori or a posteriori for arriving at such a judgment. And thus, without being self-contradictory, a judgment may nevertheless be either false or groundless. Now, the proposition, "No subject can have a predicate that contradicts it," is called the principle of contradiction, and is a universal but purely negative criterion of all truth. but it belongs to logic alone because it is valid of cognitions merely as cognitions and without respect to their content, and declares that the contradiction entirely nullifies them. We can also, however, make a positive use of this principle, that is, not merely to banish falsehood and error, insofar as it rests upon contradiction, but also for the cognition of truth. For if the judgment is analytical, be it affirmative or negative, its truth must always be recognizable by means of the principle of contradiction. For the contrary of that which lies and is cogitated as conception in the cognition of the object will be always properly negatived, but the conception itself must always be affirmed of the object, inasmuch as the contrary thereof would be in contradiction to the object. We must therefore hold the principle of contradiction to be the universal and fully sufficient principle of all analytical cognition. But as a sufficient criterion of truth, it has no further utility or authority. For the fact that no cognition can be at variance with this principle without nullifying itself constitutes this principle the sine qua non, but not the determining ground of the truth of our cognition. As our business at present is properly with the synthetical part of our knowledge only, we shall always be on our guard not to transgress this inviolable principle, but at the same time not to expect from it any direct assistance in the establishment of the truth of any synthetical proposition. There exists, however, a formula of this celebrated principle, a principle merely formal and entirely without content, which contains a synthesis that has been inadvertently and quite unnecessarily mixed up with it. It is this: it is impossible for a thing to be and not to be at the same time. Not to mention the superfluousness of the addition of the word impossible to indicate the apodeictic certainty, which ought to be self-evident from the proposition itself, the proposition is affected by the condition of time, and as it were says, a thing A, which is something B, cannot at the same time be non-B. But both B as well as non-B may quite well exist in succession. For example, a man who is young cannot at the same time be old, but the same man can very well be at one time young and at another not young, that is, old. Now the principle of contradiction as a merely logical proposition must not by any means limit its application merely to relations of time, and consequently a formula like the preceding is quite foreign to its true purpose. The misunderstanding arises in this way. We first of all separate a predicate of a thing from the conception of the thing, and afterwards connect with this predicate its opposite, and hence do not establish any contradiction with the subject, but only with its predicate, which has been conjoined with the subject synthetically. A contradiction, moreover, which obtains only when the first and second predicate are affirmed in the same time. If I say, a man who is ignorant is not learned, the condition at the same time must be added, for he who is at one time ignorant may at another be learned. But if I say, no ignorant man is a learned man, the proposition is analytical, because the characteristic ignorance is now a constituent part of the conception of the subject. And in this case, the negative proposition is evident immediately from the proposition of contradiction, without the necessity of adding the condition the same time. This is the reason why I have altered the formula of this principle, an alteration which shows very clearly the nature of an analytical proposition. Section 2. Of the supreme principle of all synthetical judgments. The explanation of the possibility of synthetical judgments is a task with which general logic has nothing to do. Indeed, she needs not even be acquainted with its name. But in transcendental logic, it is the most important matter to be dealt with. Indeed, the only one, if the question is of the possibility of synthetical judgments a priori, the conditions and extent of their validity. For when this question is fully decided, it can reach its aim with perfect ease, the determination, to wit, of the extent and limits of the pure understanding. In an analytical judgment, I do not go beyond the given conception in order to arrive at some decision respecting it. If the judgment is affirmative, I predicate of the conception only that which was already cogitated in it. If negative, I merely exclude from the conception its contrary. But in synthetical judgments, I must go beyond the given conception in order to cogitate in relation with it something quite different from that which was cogitated in it, a relation which is consequently never one either of identity or contradiction, and by means of which the truth or error of the judgment cannot be discerned merely from the judgment itself. Granted, then, that we must go out beyond a given conception in order to compare it synthetically with another, a third thing is necessary in which alone the synthesis of two conceptions can originate. Now, what is this tertium quid that is to be the medium of all synthetical judgments? It is only a complex in which all our representations are contained, the internal sense, to wit, and its form, a priori, time. The synthesis of our representations rests upon the imagination. Their synthetical unity, which is requisite to a judgment, upon the unity of our perception. In this, therefore, is to be sought the possibility of synthetical judgments, and as all three contain the sources of a priori representations, the possibility of pure synthetical judgments also. Nay, they are necessary upon these grounds if we are to possess a knowledge of objects which rests solely upon the synthesis of representations. If a cognition is to have objective reality, that is, to relate to an object, and possess sense and meaning in respect to it, it is necessary that the object be given in some way or another. Without this, our conceptions are empty, and we may indeed have thought by means of them, but by such thinking we have not, in fact, cognized anything. We have merely played with representation. To give an object, if this expression be understood in the sense of to present the object, not mediately but immediately in intuition, means nothing else than to apply the representation of it to experience, be that experience real or only possible. Space and time themselves, pure as these conceptions are from all that is empirical, and certain as it is that they are represented fully a priori in the mind, would be completely without objective validity and without sense and significance if their necessary use in the objects of experience were not shown. Nay, the representation of them is a mere schema that always relates to the reproductive imagination which calls up the objects of experience without which they have no meaning. And so it is with all conceptions without distinction. The possibility of experience is, then, that which gives objective reality to all our a priori cognitions. Now experience depends upon the synthetical unity of phenomena, that is, upon a synthesis according to conceptions of the object of phenomena in general, a synthesis without which experience never could become knowledge, but would be merely a rhapsody of perceptions never fitting together into any connected text, according to rules of a thoroughly united possible consciousness, and therefore never subjected to the transcendental and necessary unity of apperception. Experience has therefore for a foundation a priori principles of its form, that is to say, general rules of unity in the synthesis of phenomena, the objective reality of which rules, as necessary conditions even of the possibility of experience, can always be shown in experience. But apart from this relation, a priori synthetical propositions are absolutely impossible, because they have no third term. That is, no pure object in which the synthetical unity can exhibit the objective reality of its conceptions. Although, then, respecting space, or the forms which productive imagination describes therein, we do cognize much a priori in synthetical judgments, and are really in no need of experience for this purpose, such knowledge would nevertheless amount to nothing but a busy trifling with a mere chimera, were not space to be considered as the condition of the phenomena which constitute the material of external experience. Hence, those pure synthetical judgments do relate, though but mediately, to possible experience, or rather, to the possibility of experience, and upon that alone is founded the objective validity of their synthesis. While then, on the one hand, experience, as empirical synthesis, is the only possible mode of cognition which gives reality to all other synthesis, on the other hand, this latter synthesis, as cognition a priori, possesses truth. That is, accordance with its object, only in so far as it contains nothing more than what is necessary to the synthetical unity of experience. Accordingly, the supreme principle of all synthetical judgments is, every object is subject to the necessary conditions of the synthetical unity of the manifold of intuition in a possible experience. A priori synthetical judgments are possible when we apply the formal conditions of the a priori intuition, the synthesis of the imagination, and the necessary unity of that synthesis in a transcendental apperception to a possible cognition of experience, and say, the conditions of the possibility of experience in general are at the same time conditions of the possibility of the objects of experience, and have for that reason objective validity in an a priori synthetical judgment. Section 3. Systematic representation of all synthetical principles of the pure understanding. That principles exist at all is to be ascribed solely to the pure understanding, which is not only the faculty of rules in regard to that which happens, but is even the source of principles according to which everything that can be presented to us as an object is necessarily subject to rules, because without such rules, we never could attain to cognition of an object. Even the laws of nature, if they are contemplated as principles of the empirical use of the understanding, possess also a characteristic of necessity, and we may therefore at least expect them to be determined upon grounds which are valid a priori and antecedent to all experience. But all laws of nature, without distinction, are subject to higher principles of the understanding, inasmuch as the former are merely applications of the latter to particular cases of experience. These higher principles alone, therefore, give the conception which contains the necessary condition, and, as it were, the exponent of a rule. Experience, on the other hand, gives the case which comes under the rule. There is no danger of our mistaking merely empirical principles for principles of the pure understanding, or, conversely, for the character of necessity, according to conceptions which distinguish the latter, and the absence of this in every empirical proposition, how extensively valid soever it may be, is a perfect safeguard against confounding them. There are, however, pure principles a priori, which nevertheless I should not ascribe to the pure understanding. For this reason, that they are not derived from pure conceptions, but, although by the mediation of the understanding, from pure intuitions. But understanding is the faculty of conceptions. Such principles mathematical science possesses, but their application to experience, consequently their objective validity, nay, the possibility of such a priori synthetical cognitions, the deduction thereof, rests entirely upon the pure understanding. On this account, I shall not reckon among my principles those of mathematics, though I shall include those upon the possibility and objective validity a priori of principles of the mathematical science, which consequently are to be looked upon as the principle of these, and which proceed from conceptions to intuition, and not from intuition to conceptions. In the application of the pure conceptions of the understanding to possible experience, the employment of their synthesis is either mathematical or dynamical, for it is directed partly on the intuition alone, partly on the existence of a phenomenon. But the a priori conditions of intuition are in relation to a possible experience absolutely necessary. Those of the existence of objects of a possible empirical intuition are in themselves contingent. Hence, the principles of the mathematical use of the categories will possess a character of absolute necessity, that is, will be apodeictic. Those, on the other hand, of the dynamical use, the character of an a priori necessity indeed, but only under the condition of empirical thought in an experience, therefore, only mediately and indirectly. Consequently, they will not possess that immediate evidence which is peculiar to the former, although their application to experience does not for that reason lose its truth and certitude. But of this point we shall be better able to judge at the conclusion of this system of principles. The table of the categories is naturally our guide to the table of principles, because these are nothing else than rules for the objective employment of the former. Accordingly, all principles of the pure understanding are 1. Axioms of intuition, 2. Anticipations of perception, 3. Analogies of experience, 4. Postulates of empirical thought in general. These appellations I have chosen advisedly in order that we might not lose sight of the distinctions in respect of the evidence and the employment of these principles. It will, however, soon appear that a fact which concerns both the evidence of these principles and the a priori determinations of phenomena, according to the categories of quantity and quality, if we attend merely to the form of these, the principles of these categories are distinguishable from those of the two others, inasmuch as the former are possessed of an intuitive, but the latter of a merely discursive, though in both instances a complete certitude. I shall therefore call the former mathematical and the latter dynamical principles. See footnote. It must be observed, however, that by these terms I mean just as little in the one case the principles of mathematics as those of general physical dynamics in the other. I have here in view merely the principles of the pure understanding in their application to the